Hey, hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Madigan. It's my mission in life to dive into the psychology literature and come back with fistfuls of things that help explain why games are designed how they are, why they're marketed and sold as they are, and why we gamers do what we do when we play. In each episode of this podcast, I talk with an expert on the psychology of video games about a specific topic. This is the episode about video game addiction. As a reminder, if you go to psychologyofgames.com, you may be amazed to find hundreds of articles I've written on the overlap between psychology and video games, as well as stacks of podcast episodes. You can find out how to subscribe to updates, follow me on Twitter and Facebook, and how to support me on Patreon to keep more episodes and articles coming. You can even take a peek at my book on the psychology of video games called Getting Gamers, the Psychology of Video Games and Their Impact on the People Who Play Them. That's psychologyofgames.com. Ever been addicted to a video game? The closest I probably ever came was way back in my grad school days when I was playing on a multi-user dungeon, or MUD. These were the text-based precursors of MMORPGs like World of Warcraft, and on the one hosted by our school's computer science department, I was kind of a big deal. My druid, Leafy Greens, was one of the most powerful characters on the server, thanks in part to the time and effort I had put into grinding away on enemies and scooping up all the good loot before the other players could. Besides spending every spare moment I had on the game, one of my tricks was to get up way early when I could have the server mostly to myself. This let me run around grabbing all the potions and crafting materials that had spawned overnight, and kill all those high-value monsters without any competition. This was well before the days when developers had figured out to partition the world out into instances. Since I was a poor graduate student and didn't have a computer at home, I would drag myself out of bed at 4:30 or 5 a.m., drive to campus, and sneak into one of the psychology department's administrative offices to use their computer. I was able to do this because it was connected to the graduate student bullpen via a side door that apparently nobody ever bothered to lock. Now, while graduate students typically enjoyed a little more of a free run of the building than undergraduates, I wasn't really supposed to be in there using the computer to play a game. This was, in fact, made clear to me when I lost track of time one morning and one of my professors strolled in and caught me. I vowed to be more careful not to get caught in the future, but a couple of weeks after that, the CS department shut down the MUD server after receiving too many complaints that students were hogging all the lab resources to play it. That cured me of whatever addiction or obsession I had, and I moved on to other things. In the years since my escapades with early morning MUD sessions, though, research on gaming addiction has grown quite a lot. I'm frequently asked about it when people learn that I write and talk about the psychology of video games, or when I'm invited to give a talk or appear on a podcast. People, particularly parents, are worried that their loved ones and/or children are addicted to video games, and they wonder if they should be doing anything about it. They're not the only ones. In 2013, the American Psychiatric Association included internet gaming disorder in the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5. This is the manual used by psychiatrists to diagnose mental disorders. Now, it is critical to note that the DSM-5 doesn't include internet gaming disorder or anything like it as an actual disorder. Rather, it proposes it as, quote, a condition warranting more clinical research and experience before it might be considered for inclusion in the main book as a formal disorder, end quote. That said, 9 criteria were included for diagnosing someone who might have internet gaming disorder. 1. Preoccupation. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about games, even when you are not playing, or planning when you can play next? 2. Withdrawal. Do you feel restless, irritable, moody, angry, anxious, or sad when attempting to cut down or stop gaming, or when you're unable to play? 3. Tolerance. Do you feel the need to play for increasing amounts of time, play more exciting games, or use powerful equipment to get the same amount of excitement that you used to get? 4. Reducing or stopping. Do you feel that you should play less, but are unable to cut back on the amount of time that you spend playing games? 5. Giving up other activities. Do you lose interest in or reduce participation in recreational activities such as hobbies or meetings with friends due to games? 6. Continuing despite problems. Do you continue to play games even though you are aware of negative consequences such as not getting enough sleep, being late to school or work, spending too much money, having arguments with others, or neglecting important duties? 7. Deceiving or covering up. Do you lie to family, friends, or others about how much you game, or try to keep your family or friends from knowing how much you game? Number 8, escaping adverse moods. Do you game to escape from or forget about personal problems, or to relieve uncomfortable feelings such as guilt, anxiety, helplessness, or depression? Number 9, risking or losing relationships and opportunities. Do you risk or lose significant relationships or jobs or educational career opportunities because of gaming? These do make a certain amount of sense, just on the face of things. But as people like my guests on this episode have noted, it's still difficult to do research on gaming addiction, and there's still fundamental disagreements about what internet gaming addiction is, or even what an internet game is. Because people have different research agendas, different objectives, and different starting points, this stuff is hard.
And so, if you're only studying video games because you're interested in gambling, or you're interested in pathology, or you're interested in creating yet another addiction scale, then it really doesn't matter to you whether or not you have any understanding of what internet games are.
And the stakes aren't small either. As one of the hot topics of the day, there are careers to be made and citations to be racked up if you're the one who can write that seminal paper. But when talking about addiction, restraint and forethought are probably more important than they are for a lot of other topics.
And so the thing is that with something like internet gaming disorder, this is something that really affects people's lives and could possibly stigmatize, you know, one of the most popular recreational activities on the planet.
I'll talk about all this and more with my guest expert this episode, as well as those claims that video games are as addictive as heroin. That's coming up in just a second. All right, everybody, thanks for joining me on the interview portion of the podcast once again. I have a returning guest this episode. His name is Dr. Andrew Shabilsky. He is a professor at the Oxford Internet Institute at, appropriately enough, the University of Oxford in the UK. He's done a lot of great research on the intersection of psychology and video games. He's somebody whose research I always enjoy reading and keeping tabs on. And recently, he has done some research and writing on the topic of gaming addiction. So, Dr. Shabilsky, Andy, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Jimmy.
So, what is the Oxford Internet Institute beyond something with a very intriguing name?
Right. So the OII is a multidisciplinary department, which means that we all try to study the same thing, which is essentially interactive internet-based technologies. So I study games, but we do so from different perspectives, from different disciplines. So I'm the only psychologist here. There are sociologists, philosophers, computer scientists, cybersecurity experts. And the idea is that we each build our own understandings and cross-pollinate a bit, but we respect each other's disciplines. And so we don't necessarily all have to agree on how to study the internet or these kinds of related technologies, but we kind of all do it in parallel and try to get the best of both worlds, or all worlds, I should say.
Yeah, so the internet and related technologies sounds like it covers an awful lot of ground.
Yeah, so it covers everything from the Internet of Things to video games to legislation and data protection laws to how algorithms make decisions about court cases.
Cool. And video games, apparently.
Oh, yeah. I believe that's why they I believe that's
kind of why we're here. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, and I'm also a member now of the Department of Experimental Psychology here to build, because I've done a number of studies now with some of the members of the department. And it's just really cool. It's a cool place to be.
Yeah. And your background specifically has been in experimental psychology in the realm of video games and interactive technologies and information technology, right?
Yeah. So like what draws people to play games? What are the social contexts that surround the use of social media? And what leads some people to be relatively well-regulated around video games and leads other people to kind of have difficulty integrating games or internet use into their day-to-day lives.
Okay, great. I mean, I've had you on before and we talked about gaming motivation, and I've referenced a lot of your research when talking about like what draws people to play games, as you said, like what motivates them. But for this discussion, I kind of wanted to kick it up a few notches and talk about more than just motivated to play games, but this whole concept of gaming addiction and internet gaming addiction, which is a popular topic lately, right? And it's something that people, especially parents, ask me about whenever they find out that I, you know, write and talk about the psychology of games. And I'm sure you get that reaction a fair amount, too. Especially since you have recently done some research on that topic. So I guess to start off, in general terms, what do psychologists mean when they say somebody is addicted to something? Because I think we often have a different definition from lay people and especially parents talking about like, oh, my child is addicted or, oh, I'm addicted or my husband or wife is addicted versus what psychologists think of and how they specifically apply that term. So what do they mean when they say that somebody's addicted to something in general?
Yeah, no. So, so that's a great way of framing the question. So essentially, there is not one answer to what psychologists or psychiatrists consider addiction. There really is a gamut, like you allude to, between a fairly informal definition of addiction, which is essentially play and enjoyment plus, you know, like really, really fun, all the way through to some people who kind of equate the use of games or the use of social media to hard drug use, to digital heroin. So there's really, really depending on the researcher you talk to, the psychologist, the psychiatrist you talk to, how they view addiction and technology, you'll actually get very different answers. From my perspective, you know, the core phenomena here that's interesting to be studied is really self-regulation. And so this is essentially how do people keep different activities in balance in their lives? Mm-hmm. The easiest way to label or the easiest lens to frame research that's being conducted right now on that topic is to do it in terms of the very active debate that's going on around the idea that internet games can be addictive.
So why is it, do you think, this is such a popular topic amongst, you know, the mainstream press, media, and just people that I end up talking to?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of a convergence of two or three major factors. The first is that for many people, internet games are relatively new. They're relatively novel. The internet's been around for a while, but internet games are something that maybe a lot of people don't have a lot of personal experience with. The second thing is that internet games are often played by kids, people who we care about a great deal. And then the third thing is that recently there has been more motion, kind of political science motion, around talking about technology addiction and talking about gaming addiction. And so these three things have kind of come together at the same place and at the same time to get everyone to start talking about internet gaming addiction as if it were a real thing. Potentially studying it as if it were a real thing.
And do you think that's a good idea or not?
Well, no, it's a great question. I think that, you know, for your listeners, the really important thing to understand is that it's happening.
Yeah.
And that it has real historic roots in our anxieties about children and the most vulnerable among us in terms of our natural wariness of new technologies. With kind of the official stamp or legitimation that comes along with a professional organization like the American Psychiatric Association saying that something can be addictive. And so those are just three given things that everyone should hold in their head when then they make a mature adult decision as a scientist to act as if this is a real thing. These three things coming together doesn't necessarily mean it's a real thing.
Right.
And critically important to this is that nobody has bothered to define what an internet game is.
Okay, that seems sort of fundamental.
Yes.
Seems like someplace that everybody would have agreed to start.
I agree. It might be the place you would start if you were studying video games kind of as the primary phenomenon that you were interested in, as opposed to approaching video games in terms of the pathology being the primary phenomenon that you're interested in.
Okay, so break that out. What does that mean?
Okay, so like the question is, are you primarily interested in how games fit into people's lives? Or are you primarily interested in video games because they might not fit into people's lives?
Okay.
Sorry. And I'll say that a third way so that you'll have
Sure, I'll take
of
everything
doing
I can get.
this, is the key question here is, are you interested in studying games themselves, or are you interested in studying addiction?
Okay.
Are you interested in studying the kind of positive, normative aspects of games, or are you primarily interested in the dark side?
Okay.
Is it which aspect is pulling your interest as a researcher? And so, if you're only studying video games because you're interested in gambling, or you're interested in pathology, or you're interested in creating yet another addiction scale, then it really doesn't matter to you whether or not you have any understanding of what internet games are, because they are just a substance that someone can be addicted to.
Okay, that makes sense. So what, and by the way, I think there's usually no problem with scientists looking at stuff, right? That's never a bad thing. It's, you know, it's like choosing things to study. And studying them seems like it's always, you know, additive, even if what they find is null results, or they don't, you know, there's no theory, or there's no pathology there to uncover.
So yes, you're exactly right. That science for its own sake is probably the highest form. And I agree with you that null results are the most important form of scientific information that we collect and that we report. But I'll just, it's very important to note here that more studies do not necessarily mean better science.
Or more evidence, yeah.
Yeah. So more evidence, more papers, they don't necessarily mean we have more useful information. And so, you know, set against the larger problem in the social sciences, the what's called the replication crisis, where many psychological and medical phenomena can't be recreated if the study is rerun, we really have a problem in video game research and in video game addiction research specifically, which is that no one is sharing their data. No one is sharing their materials. No one is doing large-scale collaborations. And no one's saying whether or not they have their hypotheses before they collect their data.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the information that we have about internet gaming disorder is really very low-quality information that could lead to some pretty scary policy decisions.
Okay. So let's kind of follow that idea, but back up maybe a little bit. So what is the status of internet gaming disorder as a disorder that's formally recognized by psychologists? So you mentioned the APA weighing in, like what have they said? And the APA is the American Psychological Association.
In this case, it's the American Psychiatric Association.
Yeah, you're right. Psychiatric Association. So what is the status of that as like a formally recognized disorder?
Right. So they published their guidance, I think, in 2013. Mm-hmm. And basically they said, hey, this is something that might be interesting to study. And this might be something that we would think is a disorder in the future. So, hey, social scientists and epidemiologists, go out and collect some observations. And here's where you should look. And they wrote a list of 9 indicators that might be related to gaming pathology, that kind of borrowed a lot of the language from gambling disorder,
mm-hmm.
Which is the only other non-substance-based addiction that's highlighted in the DSM-5.
Right. Everything else involves chemicals of some sort, right?
Everything else involves a substance or a chemical or, you know, a defined thing.
Mm-hmm.
And gambling is the only other one that is, you could think of broadly as a entirely behavioral based disorder. And so anyway, so they published this, and basically like 2 or 3 major kinds of papers have been published since. The first is a bunch of gaming addiction papers that have nothing to do with internet games, but the introduction just reminds the reader that internet gaming disorder is something that the APA might be up to.
Okay.
The second kind of papers that we read, that you can read, are a bunch of people creating new scales and attempting to validate them based on the APA guidance. And then the third kind of study that you will read is people using their PET scales to look at prevalence, and possibly correlations with other factors. And these are studies that are typically done with convenience samples. So they'll use snowball sampling, or they'll put a survey on an internet gaming website, so like a subreddit or something.
Yep, seen that a lot.
Yeah, and then they'll report those numbers. And so those are the main three kinds of papers. And there's kind of a lot of jockeying. There's a lot of things that look like fancy stats, because people want to own the phenomena, you know, as part of their area of expertise.
So is this a matter of getting in on the ground floor of something hot? And
this is plastics.
Okay.
To reference, I think it's a wonderful
The Graduate.
Yeah, The Graduate. You're right, The Graduate. Sorry. Yeah. I watched The Graduate and It's a Wonderful Life in the same year, I think.
Those are very different movies, though.
You know what, though? You combine them and Man in the High Castle and you get a nice
cross-section of human experience.
Yeah, exactly. Nice cross-section. In any case, those are the plastics. So those are the three classes of studies that you'll read that kind of have arisen out of the swamp of the APA guidance.
Okay. So what were some of those proposed criteria for diagnosing somebody with this internet gaming disorder? What were some of the things that the APA said might eventually end up in the DSM? And the DSM is the manual that psychiatrists and other psychologists use to diagnose somebody with a disorder. By the way.
So they're basically, there's nine of them. And they center around the kinds of things that you would think would be part of gambling disorder. So having to play more to feel the same levels of excitement, experiencing distress that gets in the way of other activities, risking your job or risking your university marks, lying to friends or family members about how much you're playing, kinds of things like this, things that essentially have to do with an impingement on psychosocial functioning and, in some way, an escalating pathological phenomenon, something spiraling out of control.
So I've probably checked off one or two of those boxes. I won't say which ones, but over time. Yeah. I mean, I've done something, I've played games to the extent that it annoyed my wife, for example, or that it interfered with my schoolwork. So does that mean that I'm addicted, or is that a likely diagnosis that somebody might hand
down? No. Yeah. So, and you have to remember that this is really draft level stuff. But the idea, the general idea is that it requires that you would satisfy 5 out of 9 of the symptoms or indicators in a 1-year period.
Okay.
And the general idea is that it has to be causing you some kind of global distress. It's happening in a 1-year period, and it's meeting that kind of number of indicators cutoff, the threshold. And then that would be kind of an indication that you might be addicted. It doesn't, those are the general parameters.
It definitely sounds like it's more than just, I just got this new game and I'm really into it and I'm putting every, spare amount of time that I have into it until school starts again or until the weekend's over. It's something more long-term and consequential than that.
Yes, but you're right that it's meant to be more long-term and more consequential than that. But when you read the actual items, and I encourage you can just Google them and you can put them up. You can put it up with the show notes.
Yeah, I will.
They really are quite normative things. So an entirely non-pathological gamer, someone whose gaming is perfectly integrated into their lives, can easily select 3 of them. And you would have no reason to think that this person had behavioral dysregulation.
Okay.
Especially if you're really into a new game. And you blow like 40 hours on it across 3 weeks.
Yeah. And I'll put all 9 of those criteria up on the blog post that goes with this episode, on psychologygames.com in case anybody wants to go and see what they are exactly. So as a side question, why specifically internet gaming disorder? And does this not apply to games that are not played online?
Right. So I'm not sure that there's actually a true answer to that question. I know okay. that I think that the American Psychiatric Association was considering introducing internet addiction without the word gaming.
So is this a side door kind of thing, or?
Right. Gaming got added as part of the kind of political dimension and as kind of the political aspect of them discussing, you know, where is an area where pathology could be happening. And so that's my understanding of where it came from. And I'm sure someone will post a comment explaining how I'm wrong about that. Okay. But it is distinct in the description from whatever the heck non-internet games are. So it's not just electronic gaming addiction with an internet form. It seems like the internet is an intrinsic part of this. And so I've now spoken with other researchers, and I've spoken with video game developers and video game trade groups trying to figure out what is an internet game. And no one has been able to answer that question to my satisfaction. Even a game that has no online component to it that you have on your, you know, iPhone, it gets installed and updated via the internet. It would be impossible without the internet. And so, you know, in our research, what we really had to do is provide examples for our research participants of what could constitute an internet-based game, and kind of trust them to make that decision, because there is no such thing as an internet game.
Or all games are internet games.
Yes, or all things are internet games. But it's kind of like it's kind of like saying tasty food or natural food.
Yeah.
Where all food at some point is organic.
Yeah, it's all...
Because it is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. Yeah, but it's all carbon, nitrogen, you know, oxygen and carbon again.
All naturally occurring substances in the universe.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. All from the sun. Yeah. But in any case, yeah, so that's the, you know, that's a real kind of sticky wicket about this, which is that it's a disorder that's been proposed where the first two words in the disorder have not been defined.
They're ill-defined, yeah.
Yeah, or under-defined, yeah.
When researchers do these kinds of studies, do they, you know, like you said, do they give examples? Do they say, like, for example, World of Warcraft or Call of Duty, or do they just sort of leave it out there to be interpreted as the participants will?
It's almost 50-50.
Okay.
Some groups of researchers, kind of one half of researchers, because they're getting their participants from an online source anyway, they essentially say, we recruited from internet gaming forums. And then they assume that if you're on an internet gaming forum, you must be playing internet games.
That's not a very good assumption.
Because... Well, they don't have you as a Jamie, I hate to break this to you, but they do not have you as a peer reviewer.
All right. Let me get in touch with these people.
I continue to read these papers.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously subreddits or whatever for every kind of game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But here's the critical kind of detail about this. And this is I don't just harp on open science because I like it. It's like it's not possible to know where these samples are precisely collected or exactly what games these participants are playing because researchers do not share their data. And so it's a very frustrating thing. This is a research area where there's almost no incremental knowledge.
So break that out a little bit for any of the listeners who aren't researchers. So what does it mean to share your data or not share your data?
Right. So many professional organizations and many journals, they have rules around data sharing. They specifically say, like, if you were to publish in PLOS One, let's say, that your raw data should be available at the time of publishing, right?
And raw data is literally the measurements you take of your study participants, the surveys that you have them fill out, the biographical information about them, any information that you have about or from your participants, right?
Yeah, you redact things that, you know, might cause, you know, people to be identified, like, their IP address or something. So the general idea is that you make the data that you collect along with the surveys and your analysis code. So if you do t-tests or NOVAs or factor analysis, you make those things available so that other researchers can kind of recreate what you've done, and they can check what you've done and build on it, right? Mm-hmm.
That's how science is supposed to work, right?
That is exactly how science is supposed to work. But I believe our research group might be the only one that actually shares its gaming addiction data. Hmm. And it should be done as a value of open science, especially if this is going to be created as a disorder. But it's something that's not happening right now, and I find it pretty frustrating.
Why do people demur or not want to share their data? It's just because the publication doesn't require it, so it's, you know, they don't want to go to the extra work if it's not required, or they worried about it not being replicated, or what?
Exactly right. So it might be the second thing, which is that there's no incentive in many journals and for many researchers who are trying to rack up publications. There's no incentive to share data. There's no reward you get. And that really the only thing that can happen is people get a leg up in their own research because they can build directly on your work, or a gas, they could find a mistake in your work.
Yeah.
And so I do get emails with people who find, I think, relatively minor to date mistakes in my work. I find them humbling and instructive. But, you know, that this isn't something that happens. So a colleague of mine, Malta Elson, and I,
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so Malta and I did a project where we actually analyzed all of the studies that were published in the Journal of Media Psychology.
One of the big ones in that area, yeah.
Yeah, so it was, and of all of the studies that we looked at, I think there were 146, none of them shared their data. None of them registered their hypotheses ahead of time, so pre-registered their plan for collecting data and analyzing the data.
Pre-registering hypotheses is where you publicly say, like, this is what we expect to find, or these are the research questions. Yeah.
Yeah. So an example for internet gaming addiction research would be, other research shows that 8% of the population is addicted to online games. I think the percentage is lower than that. Mm-hmm. Or gambling addiction is negatively related to well-being. I think that internet gaming addiction is negatively related to well-being.
So the benefit of that is that it keeps you from fudging your predictions to match your results, right?
Yeah, it reduces the chance of something called harking, which is hypothesizing after the results are known.
Great acronym.
or overfitting your data. Essentially, you know, let's say you think gaming addiction is a thing and you do a bunch of fancy factor analyses. If you keep doing factor analyses, eventually you're going to find a great factor solution. Mm-hmm. But that factor solution might only really work for the data that you have in hand, because you didn't have that plan ahead of time. You just kept overfitting your data until you got key statistics that you're able to publish on. So that was the second. That was the first thing we found. The first and second thing that we found. And then the third thing we found was actually nearly 16% of the publications had a serious error in terms of reporting the statistics. So,
okay. Give me an example of a serious error.
Right. So the test statistic, so the correlation coefficient, or the T, which is like a T-test or an F, it and the degrees of freedom, so the number of participants, let's say, were inconsistent with the p-value.
Okay, meaning that that p-value shouldn't have been possible given that combination
of... The p-value is not only should that p-value not been possible, but the result either was a significant result, a report that was reported as statistically significant, it became not significant, or a result that was reported as not significant was actually significant.
So for our non-technical listeners, that means they found results possibly very important, or results that were central to the paper that should not have been possible given other things that they reported in that study.
Yeah, so 16, that was true. So for about 16% of the papers, they said there was a there, but it's tremendously unlikely that that's true. And the mistake was made in 80% of the cases. The mistake was made in the direction of saying that there was a there when there wasn't. So, the frustrating thing is that without actually having access to the data, we can't answer that question.
Or present accurate results, or...
Or present accurate results. And so the thing is that with something like internet gaming disorder, it's kind of more the big leagues than you know, the rest of communication studies or psychology, media psychology. This is something that really affects people's lives and could possibly stigmatize, you know, one of the most popular recreational activities on the planet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the real thing here to think real carefully about is, you know, why are we letting so much junk science get published? And why aren't we holding it to a higher standard?
So are there any other sort of major problems and shortcomings of current research on this topic beyond the lack of open science?
Yeah, there's a few. One is that everyone's using their own scales.
Okay. Scales meaning the questions that you ask.
Yeah. So essentially what a lot of the research is doing is having people fill out self-report instruments, you know, that are based on the DSM-5 proposed criteria, right? But everyone's got their own scale. And so it makes comparing the data very difficult, you know, across studies. And then the third issue besides open science and this thing about everyone has their own scale is that people are using convenience samples. So they're not collecting a systematic or representative sample of the population of gamers or the general population. Mm-hmm. They're really giving you numbers based on whoever bothered to fill out the questionnaire. Yeah. And there's no systematic discussion. This study should have been done properly the first time. There is more studies need to be done.
There's a fine distinction between the two, yeah.
Right. And if you get emails like I do, and you said you do, if you get emails from concerned parents about their kids kind of staying up locked in their rooms and you want to give them useful information, it's really frustrating to have a literature that's just full of so much junk.
You recently had an article published along with some co-authors in the American Journal of Psychiatry where you looked at a lot of these questions. You looked at sort of what the prevalence of internet gaming addiction might be, addiction disorder. Can you just kind of walk me through that study? I assume you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, sure.
And what you did and what you found.
It took a lot of time and it was quite expensive. So it was, we did four studies, and they were all with nationally representative samples. We just over 18,000 participants.
That's a lot.
And we looked at adults in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Canada, and in Germany. So in a series of four studies, what we really wanted to do was take a look at what's the prevalence of internet gaming disorder, how does its prevalence compare to things like gambling disorder, and what kinds of impact might it have on well-being and functioning, you know, in the general population. And so we kind of broke this out in four studies across adults in the United States, in Canada, in Germany, and in the United Kingdom.
Yep. What'd you find out?
Well, we found a few things. First, we found that in the general population, the rates are quite low. If we're to follow the guidance in the DSM, we're looking at right around 0.5% of the population, you know, plus or minus 0.25%, might be addicted to internet-based games. Whatever that means, but in our research we provided examples of what internet-based games would be. We found that the rates were significantly of internet gaming addiction were using this scale were significantly lower than gambling addiction, because we had some parallel data collected in the United Kingdom and in Germany.
It's lower than gambling addiction, you said.
Yeah, so gambling addiction.
That's surprising because a lot of kids play games and not many kids are allowed in casinos.
Right. Well, but the I guess the twist here is that our samples were all adults. So we were looking at, you know, 18 to 99-year-olds. And really, like a lot of with gambling disorder, a lot of the action happens between 18 and 24 anyway.
Okay.
And so in some of the studies, we compared it to gambling disorder in the United Kingdom. And then we had some collaborators in Germany people who worked with Torsten Quant.
Torsten as well.
Yeah. So one of his co-authors, we emailed her and we asked her specifically, because we knew she had data on non-internet gaming disorder using a pretty large German data set. And we asked her to count the prevalence numbers that she observed based on the criteria that she was using. And we found that the rates were equivalent. So we found no significant difference among young adults in Germany and in her data and young adults in our data from Germany. In both cases, the rate of people meeting, again, relatively arbitrary criteria was 0.2%. And then the third question was, how are these things related? How are these kind of indicators related to mental health? And though our measures were quite crude, because running large-scale samples is very expensive when they're representative, we had an a priori hypothesis that they would be positively related, but that wasn't supported in our hypothesis testing.
Okay.
So we didn't find that people were significantly lower using WHO single item measures of physical health, mental health, and I forget what the third kind of health was.
But, Mother.
Social health. Sorry. Yeah. Social health. So mental health, physical health, and social health.
So, okay. Any other major research questions or findings from that?
Yeah. So, in that data, we did write another paper, or I wrote another paper on the project that looked at something called mischievous responding. We know that some people will exaggerate their responses. And we found that kind of pick more extreme options on a survey. And we found that people who claimed to have IGD symptoms, they also claimed to have played a fictional video game.
let me guess. You provided a question that was like, how many times have you played X, where X is not a real game?
Exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly what we did.
I should get in on this. Let me be a fourth author on one of these things.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. If you're good at SEM, maybe you'll elbow out Co. No, Co's a good guy. So the idea there was we wanted to see if somebody was being our untruthful responders, are they more likely to be pushing up these IGD estimates?
And what'd you find out?
Oh, they were.
Yeah.
The effect is relatively small. It's a Cohen's D of 0.2. So it's it's 1/5 of one standard deviation of difference. But because so few people register as addicted, this is a place where false positives could be coming from.
So the implication would be that it might not even be that prevalent if people are inflating their ratings to be mischievous about it.
And most importantly, if this is a literature that's entirely dependent on arbitrary samples of people filling out anonymous surveys online, researchers should really include mischievous responding items in their work.
Yeah.
Or they're going to be inflating their numbers with these participants.
Yeah. So, I mean, you said that you found the prevalence of possible IGD was about 0.5%. Is that what you said?
Yeah, 0.5%, plus or minus. It can get as high. It can get as high as 1% if you look at only young adults who are video game players.
That still seems high. Like, I mean, in the United States alone, we have 300-something million people. Even 0.5% of 300 million is a lot of people.
Oh
right?
Yeah, I think we calculated that at the end of the. At the end of the the American Journal of Psychiatry paper. Yeah, the number is tremendously high. It's like 3 times higher than the number of Americans who are addicted to heroin.
Okay, that's good news for heroin, I guess.
No, it's horrific. but yes, your larger point here is that this is a literature that requires a sanity check.
Yeah.
Because heroin is among the most addictive chemical products that is in anything approaching wide use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the idea that any reasonable percentage of people would be as addicted to games is not sensible. from a basic philosophical perspective.
Right. It's like you said, it's a reality check. Like,
yeah, it's a reality check. It's if you're doing programming and you've got a number like that, it means you've made a mistake somewhere.
Yeah.
And so the question really becomes, you know, twofold, which is that if something isn't really meaningfully, consistently impacting on someone's functioning or well-being, right? And if something isn't proven to be consistent or reliable across time, then is it really something we should be worried about?
Yeah, so, I mean, bottom line, do you think that internet gaming addiction disorder is real? And if so, how big a deal is it?
I don't know. I want to know. My view is
that's
that,
such a scientist answer, Andy.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's a cop out. I'm going to give you a little bit more of a scientist answer here. I'm going to say that there is an absence of evidence that it's a real thing.
Okay.
But just because there is absence of evidence does not mean that there's evidence of absence.
Yeah.
And I think that every day that happens from here on out, where researchers are studying internet gaming disorder and they're not doing so transparently, is a wasted opportunity.
So where do you think that this research needs to go, and how does it need to evolve? Like 20 years from now, if we've figured this out, what will it be because of? Like, what would we have done differently?
So we wrote a position paper that was published in the Journal of Addictive Behaviors, I want to say, where we kind of...
I think I saw that one, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of pointed that out, and we're drafting a reply right now to the 10 replies that the journal got to the position paper. From my perspective, essentially, we need larger research groups. So, you know, a move away from the lone genius lab leader who is studying a phenomena to multiple labs looking at the same data, working on the same design, because especially when we're looking at clinical data, we've got really small samples. And instead of doing individual case studies, we need to aggregate our observations. We need to have the work structured around open science principles. So that means pre-registering hypotheses or explicitly stating that the research questions are exploratory instead of confirmatory. Mm-hmm. All the data needs to be shared. All the materials need to be shared. And we need to sit down and decide what the heck an internet game is. What falls under that umbrella, and critically, what doesn't fall under that umbrella?
I guess I still just don't get why you're not talking about video games, which have their own sort of definitional challenges, but it seems like it's more straightforward than the issues around internet game. And it seemed like it would be more inclusive of the types of things that are worrying people, you know? Like, I'm not just worried that my kid is playing too much online. I'm worried that they're playing too many games. They're spending too much time playing games.
Yeah. And so I think it's kind of I think conceptually it's a bit strange, and you're right to seize on this, which is that it's not very clear why the lines have been drawn here from a philosophical or scientific perspective. But it is a convenient line to draw. It's not so wide as to be addicted to the internet or to be addicted to a screen. We talk about screen time, but we don't talk about book time or paper time. So it avoids being that imprecise, but then it doesn't get overly precise. It doesn't get overly specific to talk about MMO addiction, like a specific addiction to a specific genre, like first-person shooters. And so it has the makings of a compromise between these two extremes. Something really molecular that might not be a very big deal because it may be even a passing craze in gaming, and not so huge as to be existentially terrifying. But just because it's a compromise doesn't mean it's a good compromise. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it necessarily has substance. And unfortunately, rhetorically, that substance comes with the stamp from the American Psychiatric Association. I defy you to read a paper on this topic that was published since 2014, in which the first citation, or the second citation, I should say, is not a reference to the American Psychiatric Association.
Yeah.
This is what has put wind in the sails of this fuzzy concept. And this is what's driving publications and citations and grants and consulting and proposals for addiction clinics and media appearances and all of these kind of things that we would otherwise see as quite cynical. But it gets inflated because we have real anxieties around these things, around these new technologies. And this does sound like a real thing with a real stamp.
Yeah. Well, and it's relatable, right? So anybody who knows somebody or is somebody who plays a lot of video games sort of can instantly come up with their own concept of what internet gaming addiction is and can sort of relate to it.
And that is what psychologists call face validity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as a concept, it has face validity.
Great. Well, speaking of media appearances, I appreciate your coming on the podcast and sharing.
I think I get paid more money when I go on your podcast, right? Where's my check, Jamie?
Yeah, it's in the mail.
Yeah. Anytime, man.
So just before we wrap up, a couple of quick questions. Where can people go on the internet to find out more about you and sort of follow your research on this area?
Yeah, so the easiest way to follow what's going on for me is probably on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @shahbilski.
You want to spell that out?
SHUHBILLSKEE.
Okay.
And you'll see my ranting about meta science and media and games there with sometimes helpful links to papers. Also, if you can copy and paste my name into Google, you'll get my faculty page here at Oxford, where there should be links to my papers. And if you can't find something, your readers can always email me, and I'll do my best to send them a useful link.
Okay. And I'll include links to those things on the blog post that goes with this episode of the podcast as well, so people can go to psychologygames.com and look that up. So great. Well, I appreciate it. I think that the information you provided is different than, as you were saying before, what you usually hear from mainstream press or people coming on mainstream, you know, media and talking about it or what you might read about in like a gaming website or what you might just hear about from talking with people. Mm-hmm. It's always great to get the perspective of the people actually out there doing the research and seeing what needs to be done and seeing what the real challenges are, because that ultimately informs or should inform what we think down the line, you know, the users of the media and the users of the research. So it's a great perspective to have, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you kind of giving this topic enough time and enough space to breathe so this kind of nuance can come out. Mm-hmm. Because really, you know, the question here for researchers in this area is whether or not they're going to take the high road or the low road. The low road will lead to many publications that may get a lot of press attention, maybe tenure, I don't know. But it will require you to ignore the larger things that are happening in science around improving science and improving our inferences. Taking the high road is hard. It's more expensive. It's slower. But I firmly believe it'll lead to better science and better policymaking around gaming addiction.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again.
Anytime, Jamie. Bye.
Hooray! You've reached the end of another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. If you haven't already, go to psychologyofgames.com to subscribe to the podcast and check out all the articles I've written over the years. Like all of them, this episode of the podcast was written, produced, and hosted by just me. So if you enjoy them, you might also consider supporting me on Patreon. There's a hard-to-miss link for doing that on psychologyofgames.com as well. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next episode.